is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're getting down to the wire, awaiting the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act. You know they come together in May and June to render their opinions from the cases that they've heard during the year. And we'll hear whether there will be any dismantling of provisions of the bill, including the individual mandate requiring all Americans to purchase some kind of health insurance by 2014.
Well, it's getting to be the question of the day. What do you think the decision will be, and when do you think they'll make it? And right now, any number of opinions out there as to how the decision will go, though few, of course, who can say with certainty whether they think the law will be upheld in its entirety.
Though there is one member of Congress who's making a pretty strong prediction, and that is Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, Minority Leader of the House. And she's predicting a 6-3 vote by the Supreme Court in favor of the health care law, saying she knows the Constitution. Congresswoman Pelosi calls this bill ironclad.
And while others may not be so confident of the outcome, Representative Pelosi cites the numerous lower court judges who've upheld related measures. She says, no one was frivolous with the health of the American public or the Constitution when writing the health care reform bill. And of course, you remember she was just front and center in the whole period of time leading up to its passage.
And we certainly can't predict the future ourselves, so we will wait like all the other Americans who are waiting around the radio, if you will, for the Supreme Court's announcement sometime late in June, probably.
And on another topic, Mark, June is Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Awareness Month, or PTSD, a time when the Veterans Administration in particular is urging families who have loved ones who are confronting this issue to reach out and get some help.
So many of our veterans are returning from the front suffering from some type of invisible wound. Margaret, whether it's PTSD or effects from traumatic brain injury, the system has been struggling to keep pace with the overwhelming demand, and a lot of families are facing challenges as well.
But on a positive note, an initiative launched earlier this year by First Lady Michelle Obama and Dr. Jill Biden announced a sweeping nationwide program hoping to tackle the issue of PTSD, and our guest today has some good news on the VA's many programs to improve access to care and also ones that are accelerating research for PTSD and a variety of other conditions that affect our veterans.
And Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith is Chief Research and Development Officer of the Veterans Health Administration. He'll be speaking with us today about the program currently underway, the Million Veterans Program, which is using the VA's extensive electronic health record system to collect genetic data from a million volunteer vets to accelerate research and discovery in a number of targeted conditions, including PTSD.
Also, I'd like to share with our listeners that tomorrow at Wesleyan University here in Middletown, Connecticut, we will be hosting our 7th annual Weissman Symposium, which brings together thought leaders and doers related to innovations in healthcare. This year's topic is future-focused, looking at innovations that are transforming primary care, certainly a topic that we are passionate about here, and I think our listeners are as well.
And if you're interested in following the events, you can join us on Ustream or follow the discussions on Twitter. It's going to be an exciting exchange of ideas.
FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson uncovers another misleading campaign claim on healthcare. That will be interesting to hear.
But no matter what the topic, you can access all of our shows by visiting chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com. We love to hear from you. We'll get to Dr. Cooper-Smith in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. While the nation awaits the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act that would, if upheld, add tens of millions of new individuals to the insurance rolls, a study out shows individual plans fall short. More than half of the individual plans out there do not meet minimum federal guidelines for coverage under the directives of the Affordable Care Act. The individually insured would have protected coverage in spite of pre-existing conditions and would be able to choose how they pay for their medical care, something many of those plans don't offer now. The report recommends the policies for individuals align more closely with more generous plans being offered by employers. It does not say how those policy enhancements would be paid for. How to pay for health care in general, more importantly, how to contain costs, still continues to confound even the experts at the highest level. Jonathan Gruber, MIT economist and chief architect of the Massachusetts Reform, as well as the Affordable Care Act, has said they still don't know how to fix the cost issue with the current system in place, and that ideally a single-payer solution is the most economically viable. But it was not recommended for the Affordable Care Act because it was deemed politically unfeasible. Massachusetts Massachusetts, which has universal coverage, is now attempting to address those cost containment issues. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith, Chief Research and Development Officer of the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States. Dr. Cooper-Smith is the former Dean of Biomedical Science at Medical School of Texas Tech, during which time he greatly expanded research initiatives there. He is a scholar in residence at the Institute of Medicine and has more than 160 publications, including two books to his credit. Dr. Cooper-Smith, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm happy to be here.
You know, as a veteran, and you served in the Vietnam War, you have a unique understanding of the veterans' experience. And it goes without saying that many of the conditions your team is researching stand to have a direct impact in the lives of vets, many of whom have ongoing conditions as a result of their service. Now, the VA is conducting a number of research initiatives on everything from building better robotic prostheses to improving treatment for brain injury. Tell us about some of the success stories that have led to improvements in treatment and patients' health.
Well, we've had a long history. Actually, we've had an 87-year history. As of this year, we've been here for 47 years. Our program started in 1925, but was greatly expanded after World War II, and then again in recent years. And we've had many successes over the years, in not only in post-deployment conditions, but in others. The first cardiac pacemaker was implanted in the VA. The first liver transplant was done in the VA. First software for CAT scanning was done in the VA. Three Nobel Prizes. Much of the early work in high blood pressure was done in the VA, including the clinical trial that proved that treating high blood pressure actually works to prolong lives and prevent disability. In more direct post-deployment conditions, we've done a lot of work in PTSD and in traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. The only really extensive treatment for it was proven in the VA, prolonged exposure therapy, which we've implemented. More recently, we found that a drug helps nightmares that people get in PTSD. We proved that. And also a lot of research to improve general outlook by athletic endeavors and that sort of thing. So we've done a lot of work over the years.
Well, Dr. Cooper-Smith, first, one of the areas that we have long admired the VA for is the way you've led the way in promoting the integration of behavioral health with medicine and with primary care. And perhaps nowhere is there more of a need for team-based approaches to care than in the population of our returning soldiers, many of whom have such complex mental health as well as medical issues. What is your research in this area telling you about best modes for delivering quality integrated care to meet those complicated needs? And maybe you can expand that to lessons that primary care in general can take away from the experience within the VA.
Well, that is really a very good point. But I think the best example of that is care for depression. Depression is an important condition, obviously, in our society, but it particularly affects individuals post-deployment. First, we did research and showed that a collaborative care program between primary care physicians and mental health professionals, particularly psychiatrists, psychologists, was highly beneficial and an efficient way to treat it. And once we proved that was true, we tested it throughout our system in a way that is unique for the VA, being a large research establishment that's embedded in a healthcare system. So we could test this in our healthcare system to show that this care could be delivered, to sort of work out what the bugs might be in delivering it, and make the interactions between these professionals, between the primary care physician and the mental health physician or psychologist.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, I'm not sure the public knows that the VA has been an early adopter of electronic medical records now for some time, and fair to say that it's greatly enhanced the organization's ability to collect and mine data. What's the VA experience, or what have you learned about the implementation of electronic medical records with such a large patient population, and how can that be used to improve research and quality of patient care? And maybe you can also help the rest of the nation practices who are now now slowly transitioning to the use of medical records. What can they learn from your experience at the VA?
I think many things. Firstly, it has been here for a while. We do have probably the longest continuous experience with electronic health records. It is essential to our research in many ways, to our genetics program, to everything that we plan to do in clinical research really involves the electronic health record. We look at, try to look at patients who, suicide has been a problem, and obviously, and we're looking at how we can improve the predictability of it. So we can look back at through electronic health records to see what visits there were by the individual who may have either committed suicide or tried to commit suicide before that. I also want to mention one other thing that I think we're doing now for the future in research. And it's called point-of-care research. And that is, usually when you do a clinical trial, a randomized controlled trial, which is the most scientific way of evaluating new treatments and so forth, you sort of pull the patient out into a sort of separate universe of this trial with separate physicians, and very particular patients are often picked, and separate ways of approaching the patient. Well, instead of doing it that way, for many things that we can study, we're doing this within the healthcare system, and we're doing it now with actually also in diabetes, delivering insulin therapy after surgery. The physician who is seeing the patient still sees the patients, and all of it is recorded in the electronic health record. So the electronic health record serves as the data, and this enables us to do studies in a realistic healthcare environment. So it makes our studies really much more valuable, I think, and much easier then to translate into care when whatever therapy is proven to be better is shown in these studies.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, this may actually be what you were referring to, or perhaps it's separate. Another innovative program launched by the VA that we're tracking is the QERI program, the Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, which encourages research that has a direct impact on the quality of the care that's delivered within the VA system. Could you describe that QERI program for us? Is that what you were referring to, or is that something different?
Yeah. Now, what it is, again, because we are a research program embedded in a healthcare system, we have a natural door toward translating the research directly to the veteran. So what has been organized is a group of initiatives, actually, in this quality enhancement. So the depression program is an example. Post-traumatic stress disorder, we are translating the prolonged exposure therapy, which was proven to work. In congestive heart failure, they've done one example of what they've done is improve the transition of care in a hospital to care at home. In HIV, we've expanded testing. There's also another one that's an e-health initiative, and that's working with various aspects of our electronic health record.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith, Chief Research and Development Officer at the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States, serving over 8 million veterans. Dr. Cooper-Smith, in addition to running your own programs at the VA, you've been selected to serve on the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research, which was set up with monies from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the Stimulus Bill, to conduct research comparing the strengths and weaknesses of various medical interventions. Now, the Obama administration is seeking to improve transparency in healthcare, and your work with the council aims to give clinicians and patients valid information that will, I guess, hopefully lead to improved performances in the United States healthcare system. Can you talk to us a little more about this project, and how does it relate to the overall work that you're doing at the VA?
It's a very, actually, nice marriage of what the VA is doing and now others are doing. And I, first of all, just about the VA. The VA has been doing this kind of research for 35 years or so. And what the council did, it had a certain amount of money from the stimulus bill, how to use that effectively in comparative effectiveness research. And what the council decided was to use it to build infrastructure for the ability to do comparative effectiveness research. But the VA has been a very large part of this, part of comparative effectiveness research. We were also interested in the council in new ways of doing research, new methodologies, and I think those are beginning to be adopted. Actually, the point of care research is one of those that, attempting to do this within the healthcare system is an approach for comparative effectiveness research, again, to find a realistic environment to do the research in, and I think it fits for comparative effectiveness research very well.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, you say that one key to the success of the research being conducted at the Veterans Health Administration is collaboration, and rather than being isolated or insular, you've reached out and enlisted veterans groups around the country, enlisted other research institutions and other groups to join with you in your research efforts. Tell us more about these collaborators, maybe particularly the veterans groups, and how you've worked to enlist and coordinate and maintain the participation of so many diverse elements.
Let me first say that our collaboration with the universities has been fundamental to VA research. Almost all of our researchers have medical school appointments, and VA research is crucial to the research programs of a number of medical schools, University of Michigan, Yale, Stanford, many others around the country. And we really work in teams, so that's a very important collaboration to us. And now, as far as the veteran service organizations, these are also very important collaborators in many, many ways. They have been very helpful. And just to give you a few examples, I'll give you one example of a program in Milwaukee, actually, that was a program of peer-to-peer help in treating your blood pressure and in losing weight. And I think it was 8 veteran service organizations, the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Disabled American Veterans, were participants in this. And what they found, actually, is there was a modest effect on blood pressure, but there was a lot of effect on weight, and they called it the POWER program. Another place is in our genomics program and our Million Veteran program. We worked very closely with the veteran service organizations from the beginning. We did a survey of veterans, how we could recruit veterans better. They helped us in that recruitment. And that's another example of where we've worked very closely.
Can you pull the thread a little more on that, Million Veterans program, the MVP program? It sounds like an enormous undertaking. And sort of walk us through how you envision the Million Veterans program working. What will the potential outcomes be?
The Million Veteran Program is a program to collect genes on 1 million veterans and link it to the electronic health record. A total of 40 medical centers are involved around the country. And we send veterans a letter. They can opt into this program or opt out. If they opt in, we arrange at their next scheduled appointment to collect a blood specimen for genetic analysis and other analysis, and they agree to allow us to examine their records in the future for possible studies. And then so it's a database, and then for those studies, we will have to get repeated consents and so forth. As of now, over 110,000 individuals have agreed to this.
Very impressive. Yeah.
20% of them have come on their own, have heard about this study or seen something about it, and have gone to a VA and volunteered. They know that there may or may not be benefit for them. They know that, but they also know that they will be helping other veterans as well as other individuals. The reason we think that in the future this will really change the way medicine is practiced is one thing we can do, obviously, if we have the genes, we can maybe predict susceptibilities to diseases. But I think even more importantly, when we learn about the genes, which is the hard wiring essentially, and then how those genes affect the body, what is the biochemistry of the body, is it proteomics, metabolomics, how these genes work, we can then learn how we might be able to treat these diseases better. And actually, we've already started that. In schizophrenia, we have a drug that helps schizophrenia in really a much better way than has ever been done before. So that's one of the things we can do. The other thing, again, because the research is within the healthcare system, we can actually determine what the practical value of some of these genetic tests will be and how useful it will be and how efficient it will be in use. And I think those things are something, again, that the VA can do because we have programs like the Query program and others.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, you've spoken to so many innovations already, but we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
Well, I'll give you something that's hot off the press. In fact, it was just published in Nature, and it's the brain-computer interface. And this is an approach for patients with paralyzed limbs or who have prostheses. And it's first through an implanted electrode, individuals were able to, through their thoughts, move a prosthetic limb and actually move to some more refined emotions, grabbing a ball and moving it. This was just published in Nature by a team of VA researchers, also collaborating with Brown University and Harvard and MIT, and but done at the VA. I think this is something for the future. I mean, it can even, in the future, through thoughts, move wheelchairs. So that's something that's the one I would point to.
Well, our nation should be very proud of the work of the VA. We've been speaking today with Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith, Chief Research and Development Officer at the Veterans Health Administration. Dr. Cooper-Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll look at competing claims about health insurance premiums and how the healthcare law has affected them. We've seen Republicans claim that premiums have gone up substantially because of the law, and the Obama administration claim that families could save more than $2,000 each year because of the law. So who's right? Well, we actually found fault with both of these claims. Premiums for employer-sponsored family plans shot up last year by 9% compared with 2010 rates, and Republicans have said that was all because of the health care law. But experts we consulted said the bulk of that increase was due to rising healthcare costs, as it usually is. We found several experts agreed that the law caused about a 1% to 3% increase due to more generous coverage requirements, such as allowing children to stay on their parents' policies until age 26. Now, on the other side of this debate, the White House has said that families buying coverage through state-based exchanges, which the law calls for, could save $2,300 a year. But we dug into this claim, and it turns out there are several caveats. This isn't a $2,300 savings compared to what families are paying now. Rather, it's a savings in 2014 compared to what plans with increased benefits would have cost without the law. So the White House looks at an analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that said premiums on the individual market would go down because healthier people will join this market, and that lowers the risk for insurers. But overall, the CBO said premiums on the individual market would go up on average because the law also requires a minimum level of benefits, and some people would choose better plans on their own as well. So families may end up getting more coverage through those state-based exchanges, but their premiums will also cost more on average, not less than what they're paying now. And that's my fact check for this week. This is Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Smoking remains one of the world's leading causes of preventable death, and yet, quitting is still a challenge for so many smokers. Pregnant women who smoke pose a greater health risk to their growing babies, increasing the likelihood for preterm birth and other lifelong health consequences. And that's to say nothing of the health danger for infants exposed to secondhand smoke. A recent study published in the Journal of Women's Health highlights another promising intervention, municipal smoking bans. Municipal smoking bans are a relatively recent phenomenon, so there's been very little study of their impact on maternal smoking cessation and infant health until now. In 2003, Pueblo, Colorado initiated a citywide smoking ban that was strictly enforced. Researchers compared Pueblo to El Paso, Colorado, which had similar population demographics but no municipal smoking ban. During a two-year period, they compared maternal smoking rates in each city and infant health statistics as well. And what they found was pretty astonishing. 38% fewer pregnant women in Pueblo smoked, and there were 23% fewer preterm births compared to the maternal and infant population in El Paso. They say the smoking ban had a direct, improving impact on maternal and infant health in a short period of time. The report suggests that the evidence should be fodder for communities around the nation to consider following suit. A strongly enforced municipal ban on smoking, leading to significant improvements in maternal and infant health outcomes, not to mention for the entire community, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.